This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Morning Run. Weekdays, 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. on BFM 89.9.
Hello, welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Ibrahim Sani and Sharad Kutan here with me. Good morning, gentlemen. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm always excited by Tuesdays because Tuesdays the day before Wednesday, and Wednesday is the middle of the week. So
you are excellent with naming your days and the sequence of it. Fantastic. Good morning.
Good job, Sharad. Good job.
I didn't go to university for nothing.
That's good. Well, you know, I'm kind of excited today because I think we've got a really cool lineup of shows coming up on the next 4 hours. On the Breakfast Grill, we've got Amir Mirzai, who is the business development lead for APAC, EU and the US for Waze. So are you a big Waze user,
Ibrahim? I am a big Waze user. In fact, I'm now a Waze royal. My friends pay homage to me.
What's a Waze Royal?
So Waze Royal
like King
is
Waze.
Yes. So I can now draw maps. I can.
You're one of those editors.
I'm one of the editors. So you can call me, you know, Waze editor if you wish.
Yep.
Or Waze Royal.
I think it's called a Wazer.
Yeah,
you're Wazer.
which isn't as aristocratic as Waze Royal.
Yeah,
doesn't stick. I don't think that's going to catch on. Yeah.
But you know, on a more serious note, I've been using Waze for easily for 5 years, I think now.
Another time that would be like
Sharad. So you don't drive, but you have no idea of how liberating Waze has been to nervous drivers like myself, like my friends, like my family, my mom, for instance. Now, I'm actually really grateful to Waze because my mother used to never come and visit me in KL because she's such a nervous driver in KL. Mm-hmm. She would never drive into the city because she's worried she might get lost. But with Waze, oh my God, every weekend, Melissa, what are you doing this weekend? Let's go hang out.
Don't you rue the day. Now, I actually think Waze teaches people bad habits, right? And I think that one of the things that Waze teaches you is to follow the voice prompts rather than remember visual cues. So I think what happens with Waze, people who are dependent on Waze, is that they never look at the landscape. And so what I've found is with friends who use Waze is they never remember the route. All they do is
follow the Waze,
okay. And they don't commit to memory the landscape,
but you know,
Sharad,
the landscape changes so rapidly.
Yeah. Well, not that rapidly.
What used to be a building one day, and you know, a few weeks later, it's demolished. Or that what used to be a construction site, you know, the next time you drive, it's a fully, you know, it's fully built building.
Well, first of all, I actually don't think it's that rapid in Kuala
Lumpur.
Okay,
I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you know what I mean.
You're always kind of triangulating. You don't only have one landmark. You always have several, and I think those are the things that help you remember a route, for instance.
What I think Waze has done for me personally is allowed me to concentrate on the driving and the traffic as opposed to worrying about reading road signs and scrambling. So if I just follow the voice prompts and just follow the route that they've charted out for me, I can focus on not driving into the car next to me, for instance, right? Giving the right indication. So I'm not switching lanes at the last minute, for instance.
Yeah, okay. But I think Waze is one of those companies that actually put the user satisfaction ahead of its commercial business.
Well,
this is coming from a royalist.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Thank you.
Take it with a pinch of salt.
You know, sometimes ads can be obtrusive. You know, how many times have you gone to a website and they stop you from going to the main website because of all the ads beforehand? These kind of intrusive
Do you find
intrusive.
The ads intrusive on Waze?
For Waze, no.
So it is intrusive
for
or
Waze
isn't
very
intrusive?
For Waze, it's fantastic. It's just, it's by the way kind of thing. Here's
so
the
do
ads.
You guys know how Waze works and how Waze makes money?
Well, before we get to that, can I just say, I think, and I've seen a lot of people handhold their mobile phone while driving because they are dependent on the Waze, right? So they're steering with one hand, looking at their phone in the other hand. I don't see how this is actually good practice and
it's
safe.
Not.
And so when you talk about being able to focus on the road, that's not actually what is happening. They're not focusing on the road. They're focusing on the voice prompt and they're focusing on their screens.
Okay, fair enough.
I don't know how many people have been killed from Waze related accidents.
Basically, that is just people breaking the law because you're not supposed to be holding your phone. You're supposed to have hands-free driving, right? Mm-hmm. But I guess that's up to individual users. Yeah. That's not the fault of the navigation app.
So following back, how does Waze actually make money?
Mobile advertising. And that's why I was so surprised when you said that you found the ads unintrusive because that's how they make money. Clearly, that is all part of their consideration not to have ads bother the user interface.
It doesn't bother. And in fact, when they prompt, you know, the nearest Watson, for instance, the nearest 7-Eleven, that is actually helpful because, you know, there's always a need for you to go to 7-Eleven sometime.
No, you
for
don't.
Instance. There's always
target audience because that's precisely
No, he's a royal. He's going to be... Now he's a royal apologist for Waze. But, and the reason we're talking about Waze is because...
It's going to be on the breakfast grill. Mm-hmm. I will be speaking to Amir Mirzai, the business development lead for APAC, EU and the US.
I wonder if there's a rank higher than Waze Royal, you know, because Waze... Royal apologist.
Raise gods. So you enter into
divine,
the realm of the gods.
But you have to keep on using Waze or else you lose that title. So I sometimes drive, you know, even though I know the place I'm going to, I just switch Waze on because I don't want to lose that title.
Well, I'm thinking of gods in like in the Greek sense. So you actually have lots of gods, lots of characters. Yeah. They're always warring. They kind of, you know, they're not always nice to each other. And there's a lot of kind of sleeping around.
Well, also coming up on the show, we're going to be taking a closer look at the Philippines elections. Now, the results are not quite, haven't quite yet been announced, but we're going to be speaking to Keith Leong from Karim Razlan Associates to discuss exactly, to get a better picture of what's happening and if Duterte will be the next president of Philippines.
Okay, so in his last public rally, Duterte, you know, captured the media attention again by saying something seemingly outrageous. He said he didn't care much about human rights laws. He was going to institute public executions.
Oh.
So needless to say, that made all the media stand up and, you know, give him... I mean, he seems to be very clever about getting the media attention.
Stood up and gave him... Applause?
Yeah, well, no, attention. I mean, they basically put him on the front page, right? Now, I think of the consequence of this strategy, he's often compared to Trump. But I don't think that's an adequate comparison. And I think Stephen Colbert even did that.
Yeah, what do you think, Ibrahim?
And you know, this guy is an outright criminal.
Who, Duterte?
Yeah, Duterte. Colbert. Because we got a video on John Oliver last week tonight. This show premieres on HBO every week. And in that the latest episode, John Oliver showed a video where Duterte actually confesses to murders. Murders, it's plural. And to think that this guy is on the brink of winning the presidency of Philippines brings things into perspective that they're ready to elect a murderer into the office.
Well, you know, I don't know. First of all, I wouldn't take John Oliver. Well, I mean, some people do take individuals in shows like this.
It is a video of Duterte confessing to murder. It's not John Oliver saying so.
Yeah, it's confessing. Well, I think it'd be very strange if he confessed to a murder and wasn't in fact charged.
And the question I'm with you on the strangeness of it.
So the question is, what exactly was he saying? Because I think with
there's also a follow-up video to that clarifies what he was saying. So there was
what is the clarification?
And that he actually murders people, and in fact this year alone he has murdered about 3 people.
I haven't seen this, but you know, because what Duterte is
you
well
should
known
see it, because there's also a fact that he was he claims that a rapist, an Australian lady that was murdered, and was raped, and he said that he should have gone first.
Well, he
now let's put this in perspective.
Okay,
there was a prison riot, and the missionary, an Australian woman who was at the prison, was taken prisoner. She was gang raped by the prisoners. Now,
he made a snarky comment,
but you also have to understand he was the mayor involved in putting down that prison riot, right? But and this is where the sexism and the kind of outrageous statements come in. He just said, which is completely unacceptable, was that she was so pretty. The mayor should have had first dibs. Now, again, he's come out to apologize. His daughter came out and said she herself was a victim of rape. And he publicly said he didn't believe her. He's a curious man, no doubt. And I think about the murders is it has to do with the spate of extrajudicial killings of criminals that happened, which he justifies by referring to, you know, the establishment of law and order in that part of his country. Whether he personally was responsible for the murders, I mean, if in the video he takes personal responsibility
for it. That's what happened.
The clarification, he does as well?
Yes.
Okay, well, I'll have to watch the video. I haven't watched it yet. So, I mean, I'm curious to know whether, in fact, Duterte will be the next president for the Philippines, and what direction will Malacanang take if Duterte gets the presidency?
Well, you know, he's got some 4.9 million votes, which represents 38% of the votes counted at that present.
Yeah,
and he's ahead by the second run, who only has 23%.
He does have a selected vice president candidate more than happy to work with. But that person is running third in the polls right now. So I don't know whether the current front runner for the vice presidency, which is Marcos, I don't know what the dynamic is between him and Marcos and whether or not they can actually do things collectively.
Okay, in other news, it broke late last night the fact that the new speaker of Brazil's lower house of Congress has annulled the vote to impeach President Dilma Rousseff. Now, this is really quite confusing because the move is just 2 days before the Senate is expected to decide on whether to remove Rousseff from office and put her on trial. Really quite fascinating, the political turmoil that's happening in Brazil at the moment. But what I want to flag is today at 9:35, we will be playing a BBC interview with President Dilma Rousseff. And I have to say, I've heard it and it's powerful stuff indeed. So definitely she addresses the accusations leveled against her, this widening corruption scandal in Brazil, and also what the true state of democracy in Brazil is really like.
And, this is fascinating because we thought it would be a done deal. The biggest hurdle to get her impeached was trying to get it passed in the lower house, and it passed overwhelmingly.
Yeah.
And for this to be
annulled, it's a curveball.
Yeah, it's a curveball, right?
Well, the Senate says it's going to continue with the vote, right? Regardless.
Well, no, actually, now they've gone to the Supreme Court to get a ruling on whether they can continue.
Right. So, what was the problem at the lower house? It was that the individual MPs had declared how they were going to vote, and leaders of parties had also directed their members to vote in particular ways. So those seem to be the infractions, right, that have been mentioned that in some ways annul the vote at the lower house. So
the annulment happened at the upper house. The lower house passed it with like overwhelming majority.
Oh, actually, it was the lower house.
Oh, the lower house.
Yes, the lower house has annulled it. The speaker has annulled it, saying that these were the two problems associated with the vote at the lower house.
Okay.
So I just wanted to flag the BBC interview that we will be airing at 9:30. It's really a good one. You don't want to miss it. 6:40 now. We'll be back with more. BFM 89.9.
Good morning.
But it's never so warm in the studio. In fact,
it's really cold. It's really cold. Okay, well, let's continue our look at the news roundup. Now, the debate around empowering monarchs have continued. If you remember, over the weekend, Sultan Ibrahim Iskandar of Johor said he wanted rulers to have more say in passing legislation instead of merely providing their royal assent. In fact, I think the term that was used was rubber stamp. Now, Zaid Ibrahim, the former de facto law minister, has come out in support of this, saying that the current opposition has failed to act as an effective check and balance mechanism. However, PKR's Rafizi Ramli and Amanah's Datuk Mujahid Yusof Rawa, they've both come out to publicly disagree with the calls, and they say that they shouldn't return power to the constitutional monarchs as a check and balance. In fact, they say that could be very dangerous indeed. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think when we look at how the powers were taken away from the royals, it happened under very bizarre circumstances. It was the late 80s. Trouble happened in the Johor Palace. The Prime Minister then installed a very interesting amendment in the constitution, and was passed with 2/3 majority. And you see, we can't have it both, right? Either you really want to have a constitutional monarchy where it is, in all essence, a rubber stamp in the form of a monarch. But if you're not happy with the present-day government, you want to give it back. You can't have it both ways.
Yeah, I think, Riem, you're absolutely right. But the question is, what exactly is the role of the monarch in the, you know, in assenting a bill? Is it a rubber stamp? What do we mean when we say a rubber stamp? I think often when we look at parliament and say the domination of, as we've had, of one coalition in the parliament, parliament becomes less a discussion, a robust discussion of bills put to it, and just becomes, in as well, a rubber stamp.
Okay.
Right? But when the king acts on the advice of the prime minister or takes it, you know, then it's not, I don't think, a situation of rubber stamp. I do think the monarch's role, perhaps, and this is something that really needs to be discussed, is what exactly happens, right? You don't want monarchs to be deciding questions of policy, meaning bringing their own policy orientation to the debate. What you want them to do is to protect the constitution.
Yeah.
So that is where I think the monarchs have a serious role, protecting the constitution when it comes to laws making.
I think, you know, the former de facto law minister, Zaid Ibrahim, is trying to ruffle some feathers here. And he's trying to say, you know, in essence, essentially, there is no check and balance. And I think what he's trying to do, and I'm second guessing here, is that he wants to have better check and balances in whatever form and fashion that may be. Because when you look at democracies around the world, we just spoke about Brazil about 5 minutes ago, how the lower house and the upper house think differently. So that's check and balances right there. Australia is having a double dissolution of parliament because they can't get the two houses to see eye to eye. It's not because they want to make things difficult, it's because they have differing opinions. Again, another check and balance. And in the US, you have the Senate and the House of Representatives. Here in Malaysia, you don't see that dichotomy within the upper house and lower house. Within the lower house itself, you don't see a robust discussion, as you know, to use your own words, Sharad. So I guess there's no check and balances all around.
So again, the question is, how do we do that in a democracy? It is by strengthening parliamentary processes, making sure that we have changes of government, or that there's a balance, a reasonable balance in parliament, right?
Yeah, for us to run back to the royals just because things don't work, that shouldn't be the stopgap measure.
Yeah, Rafizi and Yusof Rawa have made the point that this would actually be a step back, not a step forward. I agree. I think also, you know, risking the charge of Derhaka, because I'm from Johor, is actually looking at the Sultan of Johor's own record on the question of legislation. Because if you remember, in 2014, there was something called the Johor Housing and Real Estate Property Enactment Board Bill, in which he wanted more powers. Now, this is problematic, not for any other reason, that he himself is a major player in
the Johor
property
scene,
right? So how can he then be... So what kind of controls would there be on him? How do we check his business interests, quite apart from his personal, as his role as the monarch of the state, but how do we deal with that fact that our monarchy is in fact allowed to involve itself in business dealings, and therefore it doesn't come as an honest broker in these discussions? So again, we come back to this really complicated way in which we have our constitutional arrangements haven't panned out as well in the face of actual practice, and I think that's a discussion that Malaysians need to have.
Well, the other big news is the fact that there could be by-elections resulting from the passing of two MPs in the helicopter crash in Sarawak.
I think most certainly, because I think the cutoff is within the first 3 years.
Yes. Right? Yep. So Sungai Besar in Selangor is one that we're looking at quite closely, as well as Kuala Kangsar, Perak.
You know, I had a chat with a friend of mine, and he is actually contesting the cut-off period because Prof. Shahd Faruqi...
Is it a bit murky, the cut-off period?
It is, actually. So Prof. Shahd Salim Faruqi, a constitutional lawyer, argues that the cut-off period is actually on the deadline of the swearing-in into the parliament, which is, in this sense, June 24th. Once we cross June 24th, that's the part where we cross the three-year period. Hence, he's arguing that a by-election is necessary. But this friend of mine that I am having a discussion with, he says that the cut-off point is actually on the day of the last election, which is 5th of May, 2013. That means we have crossed it. We have, in fact, crossed it 5 days ago.
Okay, so let's look at the logic of this, right? It's not just the numbers. It's a question of why do we need to have a by-election? Now, when you don't have a by-election and that seat is vacated, whether to death or resignation, it means that the constituents there do not have a representative.
They don't have a
yeah,
voice.
And if the next time that we go to elections is something up to 2 years, then, you know, we're looking at a very long period for which the constituents of Sungai Besar, in the case that we're talking about, are left without a representative. And so is it something we want to encourage? Do we want to have citizens without elected representation? And I think really is the issue.
But you know, you have to also consider there are all sorts of costs and, you know, campaigning and all that involved in a by-election, right? That's why there are rules to govern when we can have one.
We probably spend more on ugly public sculptures in this country than we do on by-elections. I don't think, you know, we should be pinching pennies when it comes to democracy and, having an elected representative. But okay, let's look at some of the facts on the ground. I think with Sungai Besar, I think just because it's in Selangor, interestingly enough, UMNO division chief for Sungai Besar is Jamal Mohamed Yunus. I mean, some people might not remember
the
this.
Name rings a bell. A few bells, more than Kalam bells, but yeah.
He's the man who fronted the red shirt group during the Bursay 4 rally, you know, who had made quite inflammatory statements and such. So, but he's come out already saying that he is not on the list and he does not want the position unless his party insists. That seven names have already been forwarded, interestingly enough. This is the list for the next general election. This is how organized UMNO is, by the way.
They are. I have to say they are.
And he says, despite the fact that UMNO won that seat with a tiny majority of 399 votes in the last polls, he thinks that they can get a majority of 2,500 votes.
Who was the contesting party?
PAS,
okay.
Yeah. So this is a Malay majority seat. UMNO went up against PAS. The dynamics between those two parties, needless to say, has changed dramatically. And that, as Ibrahim, you were saying to me the other day, that's really... In fact, Ibrahim was the first person to point this out to me. There he was drawing circles on the front page and saying, look at this constituency, look at this constituency.
This is what the Ways Royal
working,
does.
Working sure. past the tears, you know, from the disaster, he went straight for the political import and noted. So Sungai Besi apparently is 66% Malay, 31% Chinese and 2% Indian. I'm not quite... these are just tentative stats, I believe, on the demographics of that. The question is, what kind of politics exist in Sungai Besar?
Well, definitely, I don't think PAS will field a candidate because, I shouldn't say definitely. My hunch is PAS will not field a candidate because PAS is now friendly towards BN. If you remember the, you know, Ustaz Hadi and
yeah,
PM Najib Wong
Pink. I think if they don't, then that is a huge signal for me. I'm really curious to see that if, I mean, you know how you talked yesterday, Sharad, about how we're watching all these different elections as kind of data points to how the sentiment of the country, the political dynamics. If PAS doesn't field a candidate for this seat. I would take that as a huge reading of cooperation between PAS and UMNO.
Yeah, okay. So Azman Ali has already come out. He says two things, right? One, his hunch is that the by-election will be held before Ramadan, mm-hmm. right? And because if you count the 60 days from which the seat is vacated, he's made his calculation. His hunch is it's going to be before Ramadan.
That's pretty soon then.
And also he has extended again, yet again, an olive leaf to actually a partner in his
olive
government.
Branch. Mm-hmm.
Olive branch to his partner
just
in
a
the
leaf,
in,
yeah.
in just a leaf.
Not much.
Actually, it probably is. Well, I think it's like a large branch because PAS, after all, is a member of the Selangor government, right?
Yeah.
But he's saying, but they're not part of the Pakatan Harapan.
Yeah, yeah. So I remember this question you posed with Hera Yu as well.
Also, if he backs PAS, what does he do with Amana?
Yeah.
Ooh. He's got a huge problem in his hand, and it's coming up in the face of this by-election.
Right. Wish we could ask him on the breakfast grill.
He is coming.
We are. Okay, 6:30 now. Time for the first news bulletin of the day with Nadia Aziz, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Give Me Love by George Harrison there. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run with me, Melissa Idris, also Sherrod Kutten, and Ibrahim Sani.
You know, a little bit about George Harrison is that he lived life as a recluse, yeah, towards the end of his life. And I think he's pretty media shy. And
George Harrison,
yeah.
Was he the first of the four to go?
No, it would be John Lennon, actually. Yeah, I was just
Was Lennon the first?
Yeah, Lennon's the first, and then George Harrison went quite recently, maybe about 5-10 years ago. I can't remember.
Is that all?
Okay. And the other two are still around, alive and kicking.
Okay, there you go. All right.
Ringo Starr and Paul McCartney.
Well, let's take a look at this piece of news that we found. Basically, it's a survey done by published in the Science Advances publication, which studied sleeping patterns around the world. So it's part of an app that tracks your sleeping. And what it found, very interestingly, was that women routinely get more sleep than men, with middle-aged men getting the least sleep of all.
I can attest to that.
Why? Why is that?
Well, you know, I mean, personally, you mean, or are you talking about just scientifically for the rest of the planet? I was surprised.
I have to say, I was surprised at the fact that middle-aged men get the least sleep of all, because I would have thought, you know, just based on anecdotal experiences, busy working moms are the ones who get very little sleep at all.
Yeah, actually, anecdotal evidence points that my wife can just fall asleep on anything and anywhere. like she's, yes, you know, kids clamor over her. My two younger ones literally
sleep on her head. They're so tired that they can sleep anywhere.
Yeah, and she can just sleep through it.
Okay, so the other findings of the survey showed that it was not just gender and age differences, but also where you live. So the Dutch have nearly an hour more time in bed every night than people in Singapore or Japan.
Yeah, so a friend of mine came and visited, and he's from Bangladesh. This is his first time in KL, and he said that he was staying in, you know, Bukit Bintang, and he went to Jalan Alor at 3 a.m. and he said that it's like 8 p.m. And he's wondering, when do we sleep?
Yeah, well, that's kind of party central, right? And the people are pouring off the pubs and such for Jalan Alor. So it's not typical. Though I must say that even in quiet neighborhoods, the mama, right? The 24/7 mama is actually quite alive and kicking.
Okay, so basically, according to this survey, it's not so much when you get up, but when you go to bed. Because we all kind of get up around the same time. Our body is naturally geared to rise with the sun. However, it seems that more and more we're sleeping later and later. And it goes to show that it's because it's not just work, but it's also other distractions that we now have.
Yeah, and habits. So, you know, one of the things, you mentioned this before, right? This idea of kind of before sleep hygiene.
Sleep hygiene, yes.
Yes, and so one of the things is not having bright light. So if you take melatonin, for instance, so melatonin is kind of naturally occurring substance your body produces when you have less light. So the less light, the more melatonin there is. But the more light you have from televisions, from screens that emit light and stuff, the less it destroys your melatonin. So someone like me takes melatonin in order to kind of rebalance my body and to encourage my body to go to sleep. But if I still insist on watching, you know, the latest episodes of House of Cards, for instance, mm-hmm. just as, you know, as an example, then I'm thwarting myself, you know, and because
sometimes
you can't use junkies or popular culture junkies, you can't get off it, I think, and this is the problem.
Prof. Daniel Forger, one of the researchers of this research, actually says that there's a conflict within the desire to stay up late and our bodies urging to get up in the morning. And I think he couldn't be more correct in this statement. And that is why there is a hard cutoff point, at least for me, because I wake up early every day, even on the weekends, sadly. Midnight is my cutoff point. It's a hard cutoff point. I'm in the middle of an urgent discussion, I still cut off.
So, well, I think that's very late. If you think about the time that you, how much sleep you need, and it's estimated that you need, what, 7-8 hours of...
Six, I think, is what some are arguing minimum.
A minimum, okay. So let's take seven as the as the average, right? So you need at least 7 hours of uninterrupted sleep. Sleeping at 12 o'clock at night is really late. Takes your body some time to unwind.
So this is one of those hard cases, right? But generally speaking, I do get 7 hours uninterrupted sleep. And I don't know how the body of a man and a woman differs, but my wife, she can actually have, you know, short bursts of sleep accumulating to, say, 8 or 9 hours, and she'll still be chirpy. But if I get that type of sleep, I don't think it works for me.
Well, I think it's more than just psychological. I mean, you can train yourself to kind of fake it till you make it and be chirpy, right? But it's the physiological impact. I don't know enough to say that sleep banking is the right way to go. I mean, you sleep a little... I'm going to get a 2-hour nap here and then maybe 4 hours here and then, you know, a 50-minute nap on the commute to work or whatever.
Yeah, napping seems to be good for some people, and I think... the research seems to support that. But okay, I'm just looking at... So we tweeted out some links, and one of the links allows you to go to a site where it's actually following the time now. And it says, in this one, it says, it's 6:45 a.m., your body should be fast asleep.
6:45 a.m., your body should be fast asleep. Okay. Oh, right? This is following your body clock, right?
Your body clock. Okay. And so the interest... And why? And I think this has got to do with, so some of the practices we have, this is a national practice called daylight savings, right? Most of us get up in the dark, and that can't be good either, right? So because, again, when it's dark, your body's still producing melatonin, it's, you know, or you're in the deepest part of sleep, or you ought to be, whereas when the sun comes up, your body is... So, I mean, we have basically are not following our natural... rhythms, and those natural rhythms that have been set by the environment that we're in, and it has to do with sunlight, it has to do with, well, you know, a night and day.
You know, I mean, children has this, you know, school nurseries, right, where you say you break out at dawn, you wake up at dawn. I think that's when, you know, that's the correct, or what do you call this, the natural
you
time of waking up.
You have to rise with the sun,
you know, and so, you know, I do believe that people who work these extraordinarily odd hours like ourselves should be compensated, because we're going to have short lives, Melissa.
Actually, if you don't sleep for at least 6 hours a night, you're 12% more likely to die young. A lack of sleep can trigger a range of health problems, give you heart disease, diabetes, make you obese, ruin your concentration, your memory, and your youthful good looks.
Oh, all that. I'd like to check all those boxes. This is making our studio panelists, the person who's pushing all the buttons, giggle. Because he's very young, but he already looks like he could be hitting his 50s.
He already dresses like an old man.
That's terrible. Yeah.
But some of our listeners, Kumar and Dr. Fu, have chimed in and they said that, basically echoing the notion that middle-aged men sleep less, and also agreeing that while, you know, you have to work hard for a living, many of us don't see health as a core.
I come from, I've heard my relatives tell me to get up. They see sleep as something as unproductive. Uh-huh. You know, do you share that sentiment? You know, don't be a lazy bum, get up and then do something productive. You can sleep when you're old.
You know, my mother's my model, right? She's an extraordinarily productive individual, especially post-retirement. But there's a beautiful oil painting of my mother done by somebody called Khalid Ibrahim, and a painter, and it's of her having an afternoon nap. So she's sitting in a chair, you know, sort of nodded off. And it's the most beautiful picture, painting that I think we have, you know, as a family in our collection. I don't actually...
So that was the only way you could get her to sit down for a painting?
No, my mother naps all the time. Okay. I grew up with, you know, with a mother who always napped, who took sleep as very important, partly because she has a migraine problem. But I do think that sleep is very valuable. I just, and I feel I just don't get enough of it, even when I get too much of it.
But what do you see, you know, the argument that some people say for young folks who are always napping, teenagers perhaps always sleeping, always napping, that perhaps they could do something more productive with their time?
Well, when you're a teenager and you have all those hormones raging and you're having growth spurts, actually probably sleep is a good way for your body to recoup, right? Your brain has to kind of process things. I think it's extraordinarily, it's about a lack of understanding of our own bodies and biology and physiology that makes us say things like it's unproductive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's why you know, some productive people, or we deem it as productive people, like Bill Clinton, he says that he only needs 3 to 4 hours of sleep because
that's
he understands
crazy.
His body.
Yeah, Margaret Thatcher only had famously had 2 hours of sleep or something a night or whatever it is. But look
and
what happened
to her. Dr. Mahadi as well.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, if you remember one of the Bond movies, that evil genius in the Bond movie, he never slept, and he says, well, I have enough time to sleep when I'm dead. And it's, and I think it's a mark of evil genius that, you know, because I think it's something that, you know, that affects you. I mean, some people are talking about Trump now and say that his statements and his demeanor might be a sign of early dementia.
Yeah, but then again, you know, Trump and Bond villain doesn't, you know, differ so much.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Does it mean that Trump is not having enough sleep? Maybe that's why he's nasty.
Well, Rel said that she tweeted in to say, ironically, if you want to be more productive, you need enough sleep to be able to function properly and efficiently.
Absolutely.
Well said. Well
absolutely.
Said. Okay. 6:51 right now. News is coming up at the top of the hour on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to BFM.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.